Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Jennifer Corning, and we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. The Buffalo Bill Center for the West in Cody is actually a collection of museums, five in fact. Visitors are invited to explore the trove of over 50,000 artifacts. The collections hold both evidence and perspectives of the history of this area, from the culture of Plains Indian peoples to the life of showman Buffalo Bill Cody, firearms, nature, and the best in Western art. It's all here. And with us today is the executive director, Rebecca West.
Rebecca, this museum started in 1927 when there were artifacts in a little log cabin. And today you have five major museums, a research center, 7 acres of artifacts and building and land. But let's start from the very beginning and tell us, what is the mission of the Buffalo Bill Center for the West?
The mission of the Buffalo Bill Center of the West is connecting people to the American West. It's a broad mission, but as you can probably tell from what we're trying to do here, as you said, we've got the 7 acres, the 5 museums, the library. We're looking at all the aspects of the American West, from prehistory, looking into the future as well. So that's why we like connecting to the American West, because it doesn't narrow it down. Leaves the possibilities open.
Well, driving into town, I saw the population sign of a little over 10,000 people, Cody, Wyoming. And I have traveled to major museums all over the world. And I tell people, you have no idea how big the Buffalo Bill Museum is in Cody, Wyoming. One has to ask, why here? How did it come here? Let's hear a little bit of the history.
It's a long and winding tale, everything started with William F. Buffalo Bill Cody, and most people know a little bit about him. A lot of misinformation about him. People get him mixed up with Wild Bill Hickok, not the same person. He was the foremost showman in the late 19th century. He did Wild West shows all over the nation, all over the world. And he was known for his mission, which was really preserving a West that he saw that was disappearing. He wanted to share that with everyone. He traveled a show of about 2,000 cast of crew members, livestock, tents, equipment, all over the United States. And then he took it overseas. So that's what he's known for. He died in 1917. And after that, he had family, specifically Mary Jester Allen, that was his niece. She lived here in Cody, and she decided that his legacy needed to be preserved. So she was really the force behind starting then the Buffalo Bill Memorial Association. And that was in 1917. We had the little log cabin across the street that was started with a fundraising campaign. We still have the collection box that they used for that. It's a little wood box to take monies to start the original museum. That's when everything got kicked off. And why Cody? Well, we're named after William F. Cody. You may not know this, but the town didn't have a name, and Buffalo Bill was given the challenge of what to call it. He thought it would be nice to call it Shoshone. We have the Shoshone River that runs through town. And that name was already taken. We have a Shoshone, Wyoming, that is southwest of here. So he thought it would be a great idea, well, let's name it after himself. So the town of Cody was established. So that's part of where the legacy of Buffalo Bill started. Really did start out as a small dream. The original museum collected the photographs, personal belongings, art, and different just basically archival materials, letters, everything that Buffalo Bill had. That was the original museum. And then from there, it really started to blossom. you had a phenomenon in the early 1900s, the 1920s through the 1940s especially, of dude ranches. The dude ranches attracted Easterners who came out here to have a vacation, to have maybe a Western fantasy, take some time to get on the train and come out here. That was when Cody, Wyoming and Buffalo Bill started to attract more attention. So you had Eastern money that was coming here to really look at developing a museum based on Buffalo Bill. So in 1924, this is another turning point, there's a statue that you can see outside today. It's called the Scout. That's done by Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney. And that was really the start of the interest in the big museum in the tiny town. She did the monumental scout sculpture, Buffalo Bill on his horse. It's still there today. It's between the hospital and the center here. And after that, we started to build the different wings of the five museums and the library that you see here today.
Well, the Whitney is my favorite museum here because my background is in art. And I think people are sometimes surprised when they go into the Whitney and you see, you know, great paintings from the 19th century, but you also see a giant Deborah Butterfield and a Ted Waddell, Russell Chatham. It's really a trove for art lovers of any age. How many pieces do you have in that collection? And what's the beginning of that? Is that like George Catlin, Thomas Moran? What is the collection policy for that wing of the museum?
Well, let's see. We have about, for the Whitney Western Art Museum, we have over 8,000 pieces in that particular collection. And it ranges from two-dimensional paintings, sculptures, different multimedia pieces. And it really is a very deep collection. We're representing the art of the American West. At a certain point, we realized it's really difficult to put a finite time period on the American West. The masterworks that we have in the collection, we have Inman's, we have George Catlin, Thomas Moran, Albert Bierstadt. Those are some of the foundational earlier pieces that really are cornerstones for the Whitney Western Art Museum. But then we also collect everything in between, the influential artists that followed those masterworks. And then certainly we're collecting contemporary artists today, including indigenous artists as well, as expanding our vision of what Western art looks like.
Tell me a little bit about Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney. Creating that bronze sculpture, I assume it's the same Whitney as the Whitney Museum in New York. Give us a little background on that family and their history.
Sure. Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney, so she came out here as a guest, as a visitor to Cody, Wyoming. And there was something about the West, and clearly something about Cody, that got her attention. And she also recognized the importance of figures like Buffalo Bill. And she was asked to do this commission of Buffalo Bill, and the statue was installed in 1924. And she was a known artist at the time in New York. So if you go to New York and you look around some of the major buildings and outside some of the museums, you will see monumental sculptures by Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney. Now, certainly some of her work is lost in the immense scale of New York and also amongst the other great artists that are all around the city. But she was a well-known artist. And yes, this is the same family as the Whitney family of New York and the Whitney Museum that is still there. After Gertrude put that statue in, that was the big family connection. And that's where the name the Whitney Western Art Museum came from. We have photographs from the 1958 opening of the main sponsors of the museum, Cornelius Vanderbilt Whitney, and also Mary Lou Whitney, who were at the opening. So that's when that connection started, and it's remained through today.
Let's talk about another museum that I think is visually one of the most interesting, just in terms of the display and how you sort of enter it, and that would be the Plains Indian Museum. It's so inviting, and the layout of it is a little bit different than the other rooms. Tell us about the Plains Indian Museum.
The Plains Indian Museum, it was founded in 1979. That was when the wing was built. But before that, there was an important event. 1976 was the formation of the Plains Indian Museum Advisory Board. It was the first advisory board or museum board in the country to include indigenous people in its roster. If you think about that, that was a big deal in 1976, and it's still a big deal today. That board had an important role in not only making sure that the wing was built and the collections were shown within a certain amount of respect and beauty that goes in conjunction with indigenous beliefs. And if you look at the Plains Indian Museum wing, you'll notice that it faces east towards the rising sun. If you're studying Indian beliefs, you'll see that a lot of the dwellings, teepees, different lodges, most often the entrance will face east to the rising sun. So we have that architecturally, but also you'll notice that there are a lot of areas that are rounded. There's circular formats, not as many square galleries. And that was something else that was intentional to talk about linking to nature and the natural formations that were held so strongly with Plains Indian beliefs. That's different. You also have a breezeway that's a long corridor that goes from the main building into the Plains Indian Museum. Also intentional. It was meant to be a walk through nature, which is clearly a force for Plains Indian people. And it was also meant to give a bit of separation from maybe the hustle and bustle of the main entrance area and the other museums, to provide really almost a spiritual separation for that museum. Aesthetically, too, it has a sense of calm in it. It does have audio visuals, but you'll hear all the voices are Native voices, Native music, and the perspective is told from a Native perspective as well. That's all different. Has a certain sense of drama that focuses on the collections. The lighting is more subtle, and you'll also see a lot more earth tones than in some of the other galleries.
Good description, because it is very much different than the other galleries, and I find it very calming, very spiritual. I love the work. We had an interesting conversation with the Bradford Britain Museum and the Native American collection there, and a question about where does that work belong? And the curator there said, actually, they had met with the tribe about repatriating some of the work. And the tribe said, we want this work shared. We want people to see it. And we don't really have a safe place to keep some of these very valuable things like early buffalo robes and peace pipes. What's your philosophy about collecting Native American work? And then where did that work come from in terms of contributions?
Yeah, those are good questions, because collecting has changed from when we first started this institution. In the past, any collection, whether it was Plains Indian or art or natural history, firearms, etc., there was a different philosophy, and people were collecting quantity because they felt like they were collecting for people or cultures that would no longer be present today. Well, we know that that's simply not true. I mean, we have such an incredible indigenous population in the United States and around the world. So what we have in the holdings of the Plains Indian Museum, some of the original collections came from persons who were anthropologists, ethnologists, who were collecting more scientifically. That often led to a bit of a skewed perspective and an emphasis on what they collected, which tended to be male-oriented items, because at the time when they were collecting, they most often had contact with male representatives of the different cultures. So you also had some of the big-time collections, Chandler Port Collection, the Dr. Robert Anderson Collection, where you had persons who had an interest in Plains Indian cultures that were simply doing this somewhat of a hobby. So what we do today is we don't actively seek out some of these larger collections and items in the same manner as we used to. We're much more sensitive as to, is this something that would be better off elsewhere? More specifically, is this something that might go to a tribal museum? Or is it something that should be going from a private collector, perhaps directly back to the tribes? If we do accept items or look for items to purchase, and that's particularly the work of contemporary artists, those have to be something that's going to be exhibited, that's going to have full access, whether it's for tribal members to visit, but also to ensure it's something that will be made available to the public as well. So it is changing over the years. We actively support repatriation here. Unfortunately, many of the items that we have, one of the biggest drawbacks to what the collectors were doing in the 19th century is they weren't documenting the information like we would today as to who made something, where it came from, the exact date. So we've lost a lot of that provenance or the family history, which makes it much more difficult to get it back to where it came from. However, we've had some wonderful stories where we have done repatriations, and that can range anything from sacred materials, but also to family-owned items where they have gone back to families, to different tribes, and they're actively being used in their ceremonies and a lot of their traditions. Those are the success stories that we'd like to have. Also, access is big for us as well, to have people learn about their ancestors as best we can.
One of the things that I very much appreciate about this museum is the addition of contemporary Native American art. And I have been to so many museums, and it's like the Indians died. It's not an active culture. I walked into the gallery and I thought, there's my friend, Jean Quixtecy Smith, and there's Ben Peace. And, you know, it's so important, I think, to continue to support live, living, working Native American artists. How do you go about making those decisions about collecting for the museum?
Native artists are, it's one of my favorite areas to work on, and that was one of my areas of studies when I got my master's degree was in contemporary Native art. And you mentioned Jean Quixtecy Smith, and we know that she passed away recently. I had the fortune of interviewing her as part of my master's thesis. For me, and also for the center, and I think for anyone that comes to this museum, it is really fighting a gross misconception that Indigenous people are not thriving here, present, and also making a difference in this society. That is one of those stereotypes that has been perpetuated, unfortunately, through popular media, through different generations. So not only is it important to collect the work of contemporary Native artists to counteract that misinformation, it's really important to see what the cultural continuity is for Native people. If you really study the work that's going on right now, it is creative, incredibly vibrant, it's groundbreaking, but much of it is also beautifully based in traditions that came from long before, many generations ago, which is really great to see. You don't often see that kind of continuity in culture amongst other artists. Sometimes you'll see artists that were influenced by people that came before them, but this is much deeper. This is a cultural and a spiritual tie that people have to generations that came before them. And it's inspiring, and it really brings everything full circle, whether it's the Plains Indian Museum collections, to see how those link to the contemporary artists. But it's also a really nice contrast with some of the other Western artists that we have here in the collection.
The Cody Firearm Museum is, I think, maybe one of your more popular museums.
The Cody Firearms Museum, that is consistently, it's number one for a destination museum out of our five museums. There's a lot of reasons for that. Firearms are an important part of the history of the United States and the West. And certainly, some of us look at firearms just as something that we hear about in contemporary news. However, think about the technology, their use as different tools. They're also forms of art. And there is a collector base that is dedicated and extremely knowledgeable and also passionate about firearms. Our collections range everything from very, very early day flintlocks to contemporary arms and everything in between. We have major holdings from the Winchester collection. We have Remingtons, L.C. Smiths. I mean, you name it. We've got it in that collection. Some people say it's encyclopedic. I would say it's not quite there, but it is darn close. And this is an aspect that I think a lot of museum goers don't pay attention to, because most museums in the United States, they focus on art or perhaps natural history or some other form of exhibits. We cover firearms to a depth that not many do, just as a specialized area. So I do respect those collectors. And firearms also, as part of the contemporary West, in terms of sport shooting, and hunting, it is still very much here today. And it's part of our, not only hobbies, but it is part of our economy and industry as well.
Rebecca, the newest wing of the museum is the Draper Natural History Museum. It opened, I think, in 2002. It explores the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, the wildlife, the plant life. How did that particular aspect of the museum, your newest museum, how did that come about?
The Draper Museum really started with the acknowledgement that most of our visitors here to Cody come to see Yellowstone National Park. Certainly the art and the firearms and Buffalo Bill and the Plains Indian Museum, they all have an aspect that relates to nature. But we felt like we were missing a big part of the story. And we also felt it would be a disservice to all of the visitors of Yellowstone and just the region to not talk about the natural history around Yellowstone and, of course, around Cody and the Bighorn Basin. So it started with a dream of some of our board of trustees, and particularly a woman named Nancy Carol Draper. And she was a part of our roster here and a big supporter of the center. And it was a movement to say, okay, we've got four museums. We still need a fifth, and we really need this to be on natural history. So that started well before 2001. I remember the early days of design development. There was a lot of discussion. How far back do we go? Do we do a dinosaur museum? Or do we start at a certain point with archaeology? What do we do? So they really decided to focus on the more contemporary aspects of the sights, the sounds, the animals, the plants of Yellowstone National Park. And that's where we are. And it is a beautiful museum. You go in there, it seems like it's alive. Many interactives and hands-on activities. The audiovisual elements are filled with birds and other animal calls. It's really a very popular museum. I think it's second only to the Cody Firearms Museum. They can trade spots sometimes too, and mm-hmm. we do see a lot of demand, especially for kids, to go into the Draper Museum.
Aside from the five museums, you have the McCracken Library, which is a research center. And I don't know what the access is for that, or how do people go about using that center if they're doing research?
The McCracken Research Library, it is not a typical lending library like a public library. However, it has close to 100,000 images, photographic images, archival images. There is access through our database, and that's on our website. But also, people that do want to come and do specialized research on William F. Cody, on many of our archival materials that range from historic photographs, of Cody, of indigenous photographers. Edward Curtis is probably one of the best known ones, but we have many, many others. It's simply a request to make an appointment, and we have a wonderful staff that comes in to do just that, to pull items and research depending on what the project is. And we have that as a service to the public. We're also connected with the Wyoming Library Database, and we also do interlibrary loans for a lot of our books to other Wyoming libraries. So you can't take a book out, but you can spend time down there, and it's a beautiful reading room. You're surrounded by contemporary but also historic volumes. Really a neat place to do research.
The Buffalo Bill was voted one of the best museums in the country by readers of Newsweek magazine, which I think is great for a town of 10,000 people. It's a wonderful thing to have happen. But I can't imagine the challenges of running a museum this size, and I bet particularly during the summer months. What kind of staffing do you need to put this on the map?
It's a welcome challenge. Tourism is our business. This is what we're here to do. We're here to have accessibility and to share everything we have with the public. We would love to be a primary destination. We do know that we draw from Yellowstone National Park. And we're seasonal. When the park opens, although we are open all year long, come around May 1st, it's like somebody turned the faucet on and people start coming in, whether it's through bus tours, just driving here, flying into Cody or other airports from around the region. And while it seems like a summer season is daunting, the energy and the enthusiasm that you see coming from the visitors really gives us energy. We have about 67 full-time staff that work year-round. In the summer season, that about doubles. So we have a part-time staff that increases so that we can really meet those visitor needs, because we have over 160,000 visitors come on average every single summer. That's a lot of people for about 4 months.
I have been through Cody in the summer where I didn't even see the museum because there were so many tour buses in front, giant tour buses. It's fun to be here when it's not quite so full. We have been talking with Rebecca West from the Buffalo Bill Center for the West. Thank you so much for hosting us at the museum. We will have more information on our website and contacts. I want to find that list to the library so I could start doing my own research. Thank you so much for having us, Rebecca.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Corby Skinner, Jennifer Corning, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Nauman. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.